This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association, member FDIC.
Okay, real talk. When did paying someone back become social media?
What do you mean?
Like, say I want to see what you're doing and who you're hanging with, and you're not posting about it on your story. I can just stalk your pay app and find out what you're doing.
Oh, yeah, that's weird. You do that?
No, I don't do that. I use Apple Cash. It's built into your iPhone, easy and secure. You can send and receive money right in messages and keep it between friends, and then use that money to buy something at a store with Apple Pay.
Did you just pay me a dollar on Apple Cash?
Maybe.
Shh.
Services are provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Terms apply.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI.
Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, this is Annie.
And Samantha.
And welcome to Stefan Never Told You, a production of iHeartRadio.
Today, we are so excited because we get to have a true friend of the show. Like, I've already claimed her as one of my best friends. I said this a while ago. Margaret Killjoy to the show. Yay!
Yay! Thanks for having me.
I try to do, like, songs and such, and people don't like it, but I still do
what?
It. It's okay.
I know, right?
Boom. I swear you just said that people don't like it, so then I got self-conscious.
But like, you're actually a musician, so I feel like this is better coming from you. But yes, we do have the wonderful Margaret Killjoy on our show. Can you introduce yourself for our listeners?
Sure. My name is Margaret Killjoy. I use she or they pronouns, and I am a podcaster and an author and, I guess, the aforementioned musician. I have another iHeartRadio podcast called Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff, where you might have heard Samantha talking in back in the utopian past before the fall of Roe v. Wade about what might happen after the fall of Roe v. Wade.
Yes. It was one of those that we had to come back very quickly to be like, all right, we have to redo some things.
Yeah. And we knew it going into it. We were like, this might sound utopian and outdated by the time you hear it. And it was.
It was. But I loved what you had brought because it was such a hopeful turn. And even though it was really sad to come back to revisit it, but at the same time, I was like, at least there's a spotlight, like a nice light at the end of that conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. There is a lot of hope to accidentally dive into that. There's a lot of hope for what people can do even when things aren't strictly legal. We've come a long way in terms of like what we can do in a post-Roe v. Wade world than what we had access to in a pre-Roe v. Wade world. So.
Right. And for the listeners who may not know, because I've mentioned it before, but yes, I got to be a guest with Margaret when we talked about the Jane Collective and the many people behind, I guess, the rebelliousness of going against the anti-abortion people and what it looked like before abortion was legal at that time, which we were back to square one. But it was some amazing stories, and I learned a lot. So if you haven't checked that out, you really should go and check it out. But we're not necessarily here talking about that. No, we're talking about the many... Yeah, you have so many titles under your belt, Margaret. When I look you up on the interwebs, which you're everywhere, you're everywhere. I'm like, oh my God, she's so famous. What the hell? but it has so many titles between the writer, musician, anarchist, activist, podcaster. You are out there doing some things. And right now, you're actually not near your home, correct?
That's true. I'm on book tour. Well, I'm on pre-book tour. I decided to start my book tour on the West Coast. I live on the East Coast, so I drove out to the West Coast, and in a couple weeks, I don't know when this will drop, but I will be on book tour starting September 20th, talking about my new short story collection book.
Ooh, can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I have a book coming out called We Won't Be Here Tomorrow and Other Stories that comes out from AK Press, and it's a collection of, well, I've been writing short fiction for a long time, and I've been writing it at, I guess I would say, a professional level for a little while now, and so this is my first collection of the stories that have been published in various magazines and science fiction anthologies and things like that, and also some stories that were previously only available to, I used to have a personal Patreon. And I had stories that were only available to my patrons. But now they will be available to everyone. And I write a lot of queer, punk, radical protagonists who run around and feed men to mermaids and squat buildings and try to stop bad things and all of that, live in the apocalypse. I don't know. And so, yeah, so that comes out soon.
That sounds great. I want to read that. Future book club pick.
I know. So we do book clubs. So now we're going to have to bring your books. And I know you also did horror as well. Am I wrong? Did I just pick that up somewhere? Because we're a huge fan and it's coming to the season.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, it's funny because I it's kind of by accident that I started writing horror because I was like, I wrote these novellas. I have this series of two novellas, the Danielle Kane series. And basically I was like, oh, okay, I'll do this thing set in basically now, but there'll be demons or magic, you know? And then I'm like, oh, and if there's magic, it's horror. Because, you know, most of the time, or I think urban fantasy often way too much is like, and then the elevators are just run by magic instead of, you know, electricity or whatever. And that's not very interesting. I think magic has a lot to do with power. And I think that when you introduce incredibly skewed power dynamics into the real world, you end up with things that are horrific. And so I didn't set out to write. The first book is called The Lamb Will Slaughter the Lion, which I suppose does sound like a title of a horror thing.
yeah.
But I actually just set it out to be like kind of adventure. And then I was like, and the publisher was like, this is horror. And I was like, oh, okay. I guess that makes sense. I'm very squeamish. So, and, you know, I used to live alone in a van. And then before that, and then after that, I lived alone in a cabin in the woods and all of this stuff. So I avoided horror for a very long time because it didn't fit my lifestyle. and so, but I can read it and I can write it. Although I have also given myself nightmares with my own writing before.
Oh, that's a testament right there. If you can give yourself nightmares with your writing in a good way, then you know you're doing it right.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, that's awesome. Congratulations, because writing a book is no small thing.
Yeah,
it's hard.
That's true. Yeah. Thank
it's
you.
Hard.
I appreciate
it. And you've
you.
Done it multiple times.
Yeah. And sometimes they get slightly longer than the other ones. Actually, the longest books I've ever written, I'm legally not allowed to say that I wrote because they're romance novels I ghost wrote. For a while, I made my living ghostwriting trashy heterosexual romance novels. And it was like right after I came out, they were like, can you write this male protagonist stuff?
That is fascinating.
I know. At first I was like, that's kind of annoying. I just came out. But then I was like, well, it kind of makes sense because male protagonist romance novels are still written for a woman audience.
Right.
You know? Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, okay, I think I can straddle this divide better than some other people.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very obvious, and we've talked about this before, and we're going off subject, but before we go back to the subject, but how oftentimes when you see romance and it has specific language, you're like, this is definitely a woman who wrote this, or someone who understands that gender level of, this is a male gaze, this is a female gaze, especially when it comes to heteronormative conversations, there's very big differences. And so it seems very obvious, like someone understands. Someone really understands what we're talking about here. And it's not your cis male dude doing this.
Yeah, which is why I think that the Nicholas Sparkses of the world and stuff are so successful is because if you kind of figure out how to do that while still being like a man or presenting as a man, or I don't know anything about Nicholas Sparks as a person, you know, I don't know whether he's ghostwritten or not. I have my suspicions, but
controversy.
But you know, if you can tap into that, it's a powerful mark. I mean, that's why I got hired to ghost write this guy. Right. I didn't ghost write Nicholas Sparks.
I was going to say, is this a confession here?
This is not what I'm saying.
You heard it here first, y'all. Just kidding. But yeah, coming back to what we're talking about, and honestly, this kind of all links, because this is kind of how we look at different entertainment that seems just so blasé. And we've talked about romance and how it does, how it is affected by gender stereotypes or those who have a bias, what is placed by misogyny. Like, our understanding of romance is laid down by a foundation of misogynistic ideals based by the patriarchy. Like, this is about the power. And I know, again, people are going to be like, you're reaching. But we talked about how this really does affect the society at large. And this is kind of your forte. You've come under this conversation. You have identified as a feminist for a long time now. I believe before you came out, you were already, feminism is real, it is effective. Can you kind of talk about your journey with feminism?
Okay, but can I tangent to talk about romance a little bit more
quickly?
Yes,
and I'll tie it back together.
Okay. Because
when you're talking about the tropes and the stereotypes that bleed into it, since I wrote for someone else, they told me these rules.
Yeah.
And so I don't know whether they're like secret or not. I mean, I know they're not in my NDA. I know I can say them. One, the protagonist has to be over 6 feet tall. I was told to write an average size professional football player. So he was 5'10" and they were like, no, he has to be at least 6 feet tall. He has to be, dominant in every sexual situation. And he also, which was awkward in one of the ones I wrote because he was injured, which actually was kind of fun to write.
Did he cause himself more injury because he had to be dominant no matter the cost?
Well, I don't know the age of your all's usual audience, but he managed to become dominant verbally instead of physically.
Okay.
But and there were just like so many of these weird rules, and some of them actually really annoyed me, right? Because, you know, I wrote, in one of these books, he's dating a mom, right? And I wrote that he was like into her stretch marks, and they were like, no, she doesn't have stretch marks. And I'm like, who's your audience?
Right.
I thought the point of this was to make these like middle-aged moms feel really good,
right?
You know? And so that got edited out. And there's all of these things like that. And then it gets into like real specific stuff around like the way that you describe like the bad woman is the following sexual acts and the good woman is the following. It's real.
Wow.
It's real head around. It's in some ways I feel dirtier about having written that than like anything else I've done. But I needed the money. and I like tried my hardest to make them passably feminist and passably, you know, like, there were like weren't gay characters in the outlines they give me. And I'd be like, whatever, he can have a gay best friend. I don't care. You know? And then I'm like, oh my God, I'm at the point where I'm like, oh, a gay best friend, that's edgy of me. And I'm like, I think I understand 90s writers better now, you know?
Right.
This is the best that they were like allowed to do.
Right.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Can I rant for a sec?
Please.
pay apps are way too public.
What happened?
Some rando hearted a payment from 5 months ago, and I realized people can see my entire history, who I'm paying, like full names. It's super weird.
Yeah, it's weird. How are you paying your friends then?
Apple Cash. It's all in messages. You can literally send cash like a text, and it stays between friends. Random people can't see it.
Did you just pay me a dollar on Apple Cash?
Shh.
Services are provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Terms apply.
Hey, y'all. Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Okay, your question was about my journey into...
Yes.
Yeah, feminism. Sorry. I was really excited because I don't get to talk about romance novels much.
Sorry. We can do a whole section on that because, like I said, I think we did a two-parter because we were okay, so like caught up in that. But
I want to go back and listen to that because I might have also just told you all things that you already know.
No, that was new.
No, you went to a whole different... We went down a whole different route.
Yeah. Okay. Sometimes I think about trying to write some really intentionally now, but life is very short. So... you know, I grew up being told I was a boy, right? And I have these like early memories of I wish I was a girl. But all of the early presentations I saw, I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and all of the early presentations of trans women I saw were very monstrous, right? They were the butt of jokes, or they were to be pitied, or they were like they had destroyed themselves, or... You know, and I have these very early memories of being like, I wish I was a girl, but I cannot become a girl. I cannot become a trans woman. That is not, is better to be a boy than to be one of these pitiable creatures. And, you know, and I held on to that for a very long time. And it was very confusing, right? Because I kept dating gay girls and we would all be confused. You know, we'd be like, mm-hmm. Why am I attracted to you? And be like, I don't know. I honestly couldn't tell you. And, you know, and it's kind of this like thing. I've talked to other trans women and other trans folks about this, where like kind of like on some subconscious level, people know this when they even don't know this, you know, and it's not just about like who I would date or whatever, although it would also be, you go the other way. And I date very confused straight girls who are like, what, this doesn't work, right? And I also got really into LGBT stuff as my like first politics. You know, I joined the Gay Straight Alliance of Maryland when I grew up. And actually, one thing I think that people don't realize is that the Gay Straight Alliances of the 90s, the reason they were Gay Straight Alliances was plausible deniability. Because if you don't want to come out, you can still, you know, join organizations. And the way that we started our Gay Straight Alliance in my school was really funny. I had these two... There were these two teachers who, in retrospect, were very obviously lesbians, not dating each other. But, you know, one of them had a hyphenated last name and one of them was the super butch gym teacher. And they just kind of cornered me in the hallway one day before school started. And they were like, did you know that teachers aren't allowed to start student groups? And I was like, huh. And they were like, here's a clipboard with a form that's already filled out. To start a gay straight alliance. Do you want to start a gay straight alliance? And I was like, I do. I do want to start a gay straight alliance. Because they knew that I was involved in regional gay straight alliance politics. And no one was out in our gay straight alliance. And in retrospect, we were all almost all queer. And the random straight guy is very actively politically engaged in leftist politics now. So I kind of... You know, I was like, okay, well, I'm really interested in feminism. My oldest sister is a very active feminist who currently does clinic escorting you know, is kind of my hero around a lot of that stuff still. And so it was just always something I was interested in. And I always as this very ally position, even though on some level I was like, well, what's going on here? Like, why do all I care about is like women's issues and gay issues, you know? And then slowly the category of what counts as trans started to expand in that People who don't necessarily medically transition, or if they do, like, quote, medically transition, it's, you know, not to necessarily the same degree. It's like, it's no longer like you become a woman when you, like, undergo surgery, right? You know, I rarely see people talk about being like, oh, I'm pre-op, M to F or whatever. That is terminology that I'm not trying to shame anyone who uses any terminology. I don't care. But it is like terminology that no longer seems to be the dominant discourse around it. And, you know, and the more I came to understand this work that that feminism has done for a very long time, to draw the distinction between sex and gender and use that to understand both sex and gender-based oppression, that lens allowed people to kind of realize that, I mean, basically, if I am a trans woman, I'm a trans woman already, rather than like waiting to become a trans woman. And I don't personally experience much in the way of body dysphoria, dysmorphia. And so I don't have a strong desire to quote unquote, like medically transition or surgically transition or whatever language, you know, people want to use. But I have a very strong desire to socially transition. And so when that became available to me, when that was included under the umbrella of trans, it's like the umbrella of trans expanded to include me. For a while, I identified as like a transvestite, you know, which is not a word that people tend to use right now. But I was like, oh, I'm just a crossdresser, you know? And it's like all of this when I'm like, oh, I was a cis boy. I was like a cis boy where I took the name Margaret and published books under the name Margaret and like wore women's clothing almost exclusively. But yeah, it kind of expanded to include me. And I think that there's a lot of people who that happened to. And then the other really big important thing is that it stopped being perceived as monstrous by a large chunk of society. Now things have swung back the other way. And, you know, I feel a little bit like I'm waiting in my castle for the pitchforks and torches to show up outside these days, especially living rural like I do. But, you know, I don't know. That's how I, you know, and it leaves me in this funny situation where I like, do I look back and perceive my childhood as a girlhood, you know, or do I perceive it as a boyhood, or do I just perceive it as a childhood? And the ways I feel about that change different times, it helps that, you know, sometimes I like by the end of high school, like my closest group of friends was just like the girls, and it was like the girls and then me, I'm here. You know, and I wasn't dating any of them, and we'd sit around and paint our nails and like skip gym class to sit in the corner and talk about goth bands or whatever, you know. And I'm still friends with some of those people. One of my best friends is still from that time, and it was one of the people who really encouraged me to come out. I remember I was like 30 and I was like, oh, it's too late. And someone I'd known since I was like 13 was like, why is it too late? And I'm like, I don't know, because no one would believe me. And she's like, does that matter? And I'm like, I guess it doesn't, you know. And now I'm kind of rambling, but some people will believe me and some people won't. And, you know, it's like, I don't pass, right? But I don't try to. It's possible that if I transitioned when I was younger, I would have put more work into that. But as it is, and then that's the beautiful, the horrible thing, right? Is you realize it's like no one passes for under cis feminine standards. You know, it's like cis feminine beauty standards hurt everybody. And so now it's just like, well, you know, I walk through the world and people perceive me largely as a man in a dress. And that's fine. I mean, it's fine when it's fine. It's not fine when it's not fine. But fortunately, I'm also a scary punk. So for the most part, people don't mess with me. A lot of people say things behind my back, but not to my face, because I also often walk around with a very large knife.
That'll do it. So that'll do it. I like it. I think that's the lesson to be told. Carry a knife.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, where it's legal, it is a useful visual indicator of like, hey, it's not worth it. It's just not worth it.
Like, let's not start.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that conversation about being on a spectrum. I think we talk about that a lot on the show. When it comes to gender, it's not binary. It is a spectrum, and it is fluid, and it should be. It doesn't make sense that it's not. And the idea that it has to be in order to fit a standard it's absurd. It yeah. is. When you really kind of come down to the same thing with love and relationships yeah. and understanding that this is it's fluid. And why wouldn't it be? If it's emotion, if it's not gender, but necessarily, but like mm-hmm. about feelings and who you love and why wouldn't it be the person that you connect to? That makes the most sense, because at the very least it's honest. And then the very most it's happiness. And that's something that we should strive for in individual lives, and just for happiness. Again, yeah, it has nothing to do with everybody else. It has everything to do with who you are and coming out to, whether it's with your gender, whatever it is, or mm-hmm. coming out and being independent in your political stance. Like yeah. that's even a big conversation. Understanding that it's for you, and that at any point in time, things change, circumstances change, events yeah. change, and whatever that might be, it doesn't affect anyone else. So why should yeah. you be bothered by it? That's such a bigger conversation. And again, yeah, this goes back to what we were talking about with romance novels. This is like this layout that's existed for years and years and years, and it's not really helpful. Yeah. And though people have accepted it, there's no reason to remain in that
yeah.
habit. I love, because when you talk about what you are going through and your coming out, and even what that looks like for you coming out as trans, but not only that, realizing the inner person of who you are has always been there. So whether it's yeah. your political stance, whether it's understanding feminism, whether it's calling yourself an anarchist, which mm-hmm. I want to come back to, because okay. I still need an understanding of that for myself, okay. who understands the binary liberal and conservative. Like that's yeah. what I know, because my parents throw it in my face often.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But all this is a platform for you. Like this, the reason that you are writing books, the reason that you are in a band, the reason that you are in a podcast kind of has everything to do with these foundations. Yes? That yes. was a question that I didn't reference as a question. And can you kind of expound upon that?
Yeah. When I was younger and I was like, I want to do art. And I was like, what kind of art? And I was like, I don't know. And I was like, are you any good at any of it? No. And I'm like, well, what am I going to do? You know, and I tried. I was like, I'm going to learn how to paint. And I'm okay painting, but no one's going to, that's not my career path. And, you know, and writing more than anything else, writing fiction was something I was more interested in. I also, when I was younger, used to write poetry, and I aspire to become good enough to go back to writing poetry, but I don't write much of it right now. But, and so I started kind of, yeah, I like started doing all of these things and slowly expanding the list of things that I do, the number of plates I have spinning, unfortunately. And usually what I do is, if I have something I want to say, I think about what the best medium to say that is, and then go out and try and say it in that way. You know, there's certain things, certain ideas that come across in different ways better. And for example, I think that music is a really good way to put someone in an emotional space, or put yourself in an emotional space. It's not a particularly good way to be pedantic. It's not a very good way to teach someone something. It's not a very good way to express complex political ideas or interpersonal ideas. However, it's not terrible at those things. I think that Riot Girl has shown us, and anarcho-punk and hip-hop, and a lot of different very direct forms of communication have come through from music, right? But overall, I tend to use it when I have something sort of more emotional to say. And then if I have something cultural to say, I often write it in fiction about, like, how can people interact with each other, right? Because a lot of my political ideas, they're a little bit less about, like, and here's how the legislative branch, or in my case, it would be like, here's how the Anarchist Federation, you know, disseminates goods across the different collectives that control the worker-owned cooperatives of, you know, these areas or whatever, right? Which would be like the political or economic structure of anarchism, as is sort of understood in a 20th century, at least, context. But I'm much more interested in, for me, to use anarchism as the example, because it's what I'm more familiar with, ways of relating to each other, ways of creating cultures of consent and consensus is what's interesting to me. So I like writing characters interacting with each other more than I like writing nonfiction, because if I was writing nonfiction, it would just be like, we should be consensual in our relationships with each other, you know, and it's much easier to just like draw that, right? And you can and then you can get into the fun stuff, like what does a romance novel look like in a, you know, culture of consent, where, like, even if it's a monogamous relationship, it's monogamous in the context of polyamory as available to these characters, but they choose monogamy. What does that look like? What does it look like to consent to that? You know, and in this case, I'm actually literally quoting Ursula Le Guin is probably my like main role model of an author, and actually wrote specifically about that in this book called The Dispossessed, about like, you know, these characters who could absolutely, it's even the norm to be polyamorous. They choose to be committed to each other. And it creates this type of romance that you're not going to run across, even though it's a monogamous relationship. It doesn't look like what the monogamous relationships we get presented with are. So that's why I like writing fiction. And then with podcasts, you know, I mean, it was different. I have one podcast called Live Like the World is Dying, which is a preparedness podcast. And my stated goal here is to take preparedness culture away from the right wing. Because this individualistic, everyone hide in their bunker and stockpile ammo and food thing is nonsensical. It'll get everyone killed. It won't stop the crises of the world. And it won't even help those individuals live very long. Because unless all of them are surgeons and have another one around, they're not going to be able to do anything when their appendix bursts. And what I want to be able to communicate to people is that society is what creates safety. And society is what allows us to live full and happy and free lives, right? Because freedom, as I understand it, is not something that exists in a vacuum. Freedom is a relationship between people. Freedom is something that we give one another. And so to be totally alone, I'm not free because I can't do everything I want to do. All I can do is try not to die if I'm just totally alone. The only way in which freedom becomes a liberty is if you're rich as hell, because then you can hire everyone to do everything for you. So you're still not actually alone doing things. You're just making all the decisions yourself. Anyway, okay, so if I want to get across that idea, apparently what I do is come onto your podcast and say it. But but in general, what I do is, you know, I run this podcast where I interview people about compost, or I interview people about, you know, community gardens, or, you know, activist modes that are working for them, or whatever. And then the other one that I do is called Cool People Did Cool Stuff. And it's how I try to show people that we can have agency, and that we can, you know, because we keep getting told by society that we don't have agency, that we can't do what we want. We have to appeal to other people in power to get things done. And that is my work. As an anarchist, I believe in responsibility and freedom as the two sort of core concepts. And so my work is to try to help people understand we can have agency. And here are all these people in the past who have taken agency over bad situations. And they don't always win, right? Unfortunately, they often don't win. But winning and losing is a really weird concept when we're mortal. Because, like, I don't know, the difference between dying trying to make things better or dying in a world that didn't make things better, I'm still dying, you know? like we can't have dying be a massive negative in our lives, because we're stuck with it, you know? That's going to happen. And so I want to, so if I want to try and get across this concept of agency, that is the other format I use for it. And I don't know, I just love all of the different way all of these different formats work. And I don't do all of them, right? There's so many good ideas that are just not, you know, I probably won't write a, like, I do write nonfiction, actually, now that I say that. as soon as I start saying that, I'm like, no, but I want to do everything.
I was going to say, you do a lot of things.
Though. Yeah, I get really sad. I was rewatching The Hobbit, which I like more than almost anyone I know. And
yeah.
And I was just like thinking about the elves, being like, man, if I was an elf, I'd be like, for 20 years, I'm just going to be a blacksmith. I'm just going to make swords for 10, 20 years. Oh, okay, that's done. All right, now I'm going to write poetry for 20 years. Or like, now I'm going to go and like do childcare for my friends for 20 years. You know, I'll just specialize in all these different things. Anyway,
I love it.
I get it.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that.
With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Samantha's already mentioned it, and you've alluded to it a lot. Can you explain what being an anarchist is and what you think that has to do with feminism?
Sure. So I understand anarchism as two separate things that are related. And one is a sort of ideological movement that came out of European socialism. And it actually predates Marxism and a lot of the other very specific isms within socialism. It was basically people who were like, well, the state and capitalism are bad. They are both oppressive forces and we should do without them and we should do things as communities. And then the sort of the subsects that come up within that ideological position that was originally kind of mid-19th century, 1840s or so, there's like mutualist anarchism, which still uses markets and banks, but they're like people's banks and there's no ability to maintain capital and wield it against other people, versus like a communalist or a communist anarchism, which are not the same, but are like much more what people imagine of like leftism, where we all like kind of get together and share. And it was positioned within the sort of ideological framework of socialism, which is the general overall capitalists shouldn't run everything and overall society should run things instead, right? Like the who owns the means of production is the big thing. Like who owns the factories? Is it the people who own the factories? Is it the workers who own the factories, et cetera? And so that is the anarchist sort of tradition that I come from. And anarchists are kind of the most, I would claim probably the most misunderstood of these different positions, because originally, we kind of had this stereotype of we're the people who like throw bombs and kill kings. I am not embarrassed of the fact that we used to kill kings. Someone says that they're in charge of everyone else, and someone says, no, you're not. That's okay by me, right? But, you know, that if that is, people have this perception of anarchists as only the people who are trying to destroy the existent, rather than create a society based on equality, based on non-hierarchy. And so the largest example of an anarchist society that is the most, that we have the most information about, at least as a consciously anarchist society, was during the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s, when anarchists were the majority, I believe, of the labor movement in Spain. And so when this war broke out, when Franco invaded and tried to declare fascism within, and had tried to do a coup, basically, anarchists were on the front lines and prevented that from happening. And then in that lack of the Republic having state power, the anarchists started running everything. And they had a lot of organizations in place. This is the other misconception that people have about anarchism. So anarchism is not anti-organization. Anarchism is purely anti-authoritarian organization, where someone tells you what to do in a way that you don't have a say over. And they still create structures but they're bottom-up structures instead of top-down structures. So a lot of anarchists talk about federations. And so goods can still be transported everywhere and things can be made and things can be done and society can function, I believe, within this type of framework. And one of the other main distinctions of it is that anarchists don't tend to separate the means from the ends. So theoretically, a state communist or a communist, a Marxist communist, a Marxist-Leninist, et cetera, believe in the creation of communism, which is a society without a state. But they create a state or take the state in order to do that. Anarchists believe that the means and the ends are inseparable. And this is where it ties into feminism for me. Well, one, anarchist feminism has been a large part of the feminist movement throughout history, and feminism has been a large part of the anarchist movement. But this idea that the means and the ends are inseparable, the idea of like our goal is to give more people more agency over their own lives. Our goal is to teach consent and teach ways of relating to each other as equals. Whether or not even like we win and we get an anarchist society, our goal is to infuse our interpersonal relationships with this sense of equality and agency. And so direct action is often a major focus of anarchism. And so, and actually, a thing that came up in my research, I researched the Jane Collective, who are amazing, and they mostly come from a socialist position. And that allowed them to think, we don't care about legality, we're going to get this done. And, you know, Jane Collective, I presume most people are aware, but was an underground abortion provider in Chicago that did an amazing work. I later discovered that anarchists in Germany in the 1920s and 30s ran 300 different illegal abortion providers all across Germany. And they didn't do it in the name of anarchism. It's just that this feminist movement that was providing abortion came out of the anarchist organizing tradition. And because they had that, we're good at illegal stuff, we care about agency, we care about all of these things, they set up 300 clinics. I'm going to have my numbers fuzzy when I say this stuff. I don't have my notes in front of me. Please don't quote me directly. Well, you all. But I mean, like anyone listening at home, you know, don't be like exactly 300, you know. And I read that and I was just so excited and I want to know more about that, you know. And I only know the like Cliff's Notes versions because there's a lot of really old books that I have to read in order to really understand it. Yeah. So that's what it is for me. It's a thing that means a lot of different things to different people. Oh, but at the very beginning, I said it's two things. And one, it's this specific ideological tradition. And then two, it's its own concept, which has existed long before it's had a name. And there's a lot of people doing work, especially from non-European backgrounds, about anarchic organizing that has very similar like means and ends, but doesn't come from, well, this old dead white guy with a beard said this, and instead are like our traditions that are coming from North America or our traditions that are coming from, you know, West Africa or whatever, like tie in very well to this, and this is how we see things, you know? Yeah, that's, I don't know if that was a good 101 or not, but
no.
That's where I'm coming from politically.
It was very good. I love that. Because, yeah, I don't, like I said, the history is very fuzzy for me because, I said, I grew up in North Georgia where everything's very binary anyway. And when it comes to politics, either you're with us or you aren't kind of conversations, and having this level of like, oh, anarchist has always been not a bad word necessarily, but not necessarily a good one either.
Totally.
So it's kind of like, it's with the foreigners. You got to put it out there. It's not part of the U.S. culture, and especially mountain culture.
Mm-hmm.
That's from me. But like, that's a lot of like learning lessons of like, okay, this is exactly where I am in my standpoint. I didn't know what it was necessarily, not necessarily like bombing kings. I'm not talking about that.
Yeah, yeah.
But in general, just like finding out what it is to be autonomous and understanding that as a group, we do things better. The societal aspect of everything, and of course, you know, we're not going to talk about communism and how that does lie within the patriarchal ideals.
Right.
But what I'm talking about in understanding, I became a social worker because I wanted to work for the collective. I wanted to be one who did a macro practice over a micro ideal. And that's a big debate within social work. When I was in social work, I don't know if it's changed because it's been a minute since I've been in school, but that was a big debate about the macro and micro of helping a community and society and what does that look like and what did social work begin to be. It came out of a macro practice in helping communities. Mm-hmm. That's where it came to, and then it got dissected into, well, I'll be a therapist, which is not a bad thing. Please understand, I believe that helps as well a community when it's done correctly. But yeah, this like understanding is like, oh, okay, I've been practicing this. This makes sense. Oh, okay, when we talk about feminism, especially when we talk about intersectional feminism, which is where we are today, and it's shifted a lot when we talk about feminism. Feminism from the origins of the word to today has shifted greatly in a good way, I hope, as we are, you're right, we have tracked backwards as now we can at least differentiate those who are bad players when it comes to feminism, such as TERS, such as the Rawlings fan base that sticks with her, with her stupidity. I'll let that out, But I think there's a whole level of conversation when we talk about politics and understanding our platforms and growing together. And what does feminism look like? And we had to revisit that often. Annie and I, honestly, probably every year or so, come back and have a conversation of, okay, this is the things that we've learned. This is what we see in society. This is what we know that is changing vastly with the Black Lives Matter, misogyny noir. You know you have to revamp that conversation about feminism. And I think as we are going back to seeing the negativity towards the queer community, the negativity towards the trans community, we have to come back and revisit this conversation. What does feminism look like today? So in your opinion, and this is a big question, and I'm sorry for this, because this is how I do. Do you think when you came out, your perspective of feminism changed in a positive, negative manner? A, that's part one. B, what do you see as a positive in feminism today and as a negative in feminism today?
Yeah. So I'm going to answer the second part first, I think. I think that intersectionality is the main beautiful thing that is happening to feminism, and having people understand the way that, well, just literally how intersections work and how the issues that affect rich white women are very different than the issues that affect rich Black women, that are very different from the issues that affect, you know, poor people of color. And it allows us to hopefully be better to one another and to understand that, like, instead of this, like, that we're all fighting in solidarity with each other rather than as a united mass, right? Because we are all coming into feminism with our own needs and our own priorities. But we can stand together because we understand what we do have in common and what we don't, and how we can, you know, and how I can assume that, well, like, okay, for example, Roe v. Wade affects me, but it does not affect me bodily, right? I mean, if it destroys the right to privacy and it gets used to prevent people from medically transitioning, yes. But, like, I'm not having an abortion anytime soon, unless medical, you know, unless medical technology advances. And there's always that joke about, like, wanting to be the first trans woman to get an abortion, you know, just to piss off everyone. But and while abortion is more than a woman's issue, because it affects people who are not women bodily, you know, it affects trans people, certain intersex people, certain non-binary people, you know, it affects a lot of people, right, who are not women. It also is gender-based discrimination. And that gender-based discrimination looks real similar to the people who are telling me what I can do with my body. And even if it wasn't, something that affects most women affects me, right? And so being able to say, like, this matters to me, and, like, I don't know, it's just like finding these points of solidarity. I think that this is, like, what intersectionality is really good for. I think that especially now, and I think this is a newer addition, we're starting to see class introduced to it, into this intersectionality as well. And I think that that's vital. I think one of the problems of the old left is they reduced everything to class, right? But one of the problems with the sort of essentially liberal feminism is that it cuts class out of intersectionality sometimes. I don't actually believe the average person who identifies as a liberal does, but the sort of like...
The agenda?
Yeah, the larger, you know, there's such a difference between like liberal politicians and liberals, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so I think that the introduction of class is very important because it's all related to power. It all comes back to power as far as I'm concerned. And class is a very strong indicator of power, but so is race, so is ethnicity, so is gender, so is sexual orientation. So there's so many other things that also relate to power.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Hey, y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In terms of what I think feminism, where feminism is like misstepped, or the things that are going badly, fortunately, I think the U.S. has like largely avoided this because the right wing has a monopoly on hating trans people. In the United States, you know, it became a culture war thing to not allow anyone to be non-binary, not allow anyone to be trans or whatever within the United States along right-left lines. So by and large, I don't run across feminists who are like, they, them, that's awful, or whatever, you know, or like, you're not a real woman, you're a, you know, man in drag or whatever. I'm like, I honestly don't care, whatever. I'm actually me. My pronouns are I, you know, like, but in terms of how society views me, like, I'm finding the best possible, the most useful description to provide for other people, you know. But it is a problem, I think, with feminism internationally and specifically in the UK right now. And it could creep in the United States. And so I really, I feel like I try to you know, I think, well, kind of have to, but we all try to kind of like keep that from creeping in is the TERF thing, is the idea that feminism excludes trans people, which is just historically myopic. You know, all of these things have all been related. Even if you look at the history of understanding homosexuality, you know, transness was not a distinct category for a very long time. Of course, the people who started to distinguish it were some Germans who then the Nazis came and burned all their books and killed the first woman to medically transition. The famous book burning photos, whenever you see that famous photo of Nazis burning books, it was the Institute for Sexual... I don't have it off the top of my head. It's Hirschfeld's Institute, where he studied homosexuality and transness and, you know, was one of the first medical practitioners to say, like, hey, if you allow trans people to live as their chosen identity, everything is better and they are medically healthier, you know? Mm-hmm. Anyway, I don't know why I'm rambling about that. But so I guess I would say that's the advantages and disadvantages. I think feminism is mostly just doing well and It has more it needs to do. It has more, especially, I think, continuing, especially along race lines. There's like way more that feminism needs to do. But what was the first of the two questions?
I was asking that since you transitioned, came out, has anything changed in your perspective of feminism?
Yeah, it took me a really long time to feel comfortable eyeing myself in conversations about feminism. I spent a very long time and put a lot of work into being like an ally. Right? Like I used to write zines and stuff that were like feminism for men, you know, and not taking up conversational space was very important to me. And so I like very much, all of my attention was focused outward towards like non-feminism or towards, particularly towards men, to be like, hey, here's ways to be more feminist. And so, you know, there's like this outsider syndrome, right, that I have around it. And I actually really appreciate the work that folks like you do. I mean, even like inviting me here on this, you know, and the degree to which like so many, you know, cis women and AFAB people in general have this work they've done to be like, no, what are you talking about? Like, no, it's actually totally fine, you know? And I remember the first time I was invited to like an all women's full moon circle, you know, and they were just like, hey, and I was kind of their test case, right? They had like, actually, I really respect them for this. They had just split. They were all cis women, like, you know, full moon, like ritual collective, right? And they had this hypothetical conversation about whether or not they should include trans women. And it got so heated that it split into two groups. And I really appreciate the people who were like, this is so important to me that even though it's a hypothetical, we will like stand our ground around this. You know, and I felt a little bit like recruited where they were like, ah, like come join us, you know?
Oh no.
But like, it was mostly just good. Like,
yeah.
You know, so yeah, I guess that's how my view on it changes, is literally like including myself in it in a more direct way. And then allowing myself to... Because I think when you're an ally to a movement, you can promote the work of people within that movement, but you generally don't try to like shape it or direct it or whatever, you know? And allowing myself to feel comfortable having a say is really interesting and still something that I still don't totally know. And it helps that at the end of the day, I'm like, well, I have a say about me, right? And my perspective. I'm really not trying to, and that actually, that's where it comes with intersectionality in a good way, right? It's like, because I can't speak to the experiences of most women. I can speak to my experience, you know, which is as a white trans woman, which is a specific set of things, you know.
Well, as we've been discussing throughout this, you are so, so busy. You're doing so much. Just out of curiosity, because we like to ask this, is mm-hmm. there anything that you do to kind of balance those things out, like self-care wise? How do you make sure that it's not too much?
Well, my idea of relaxing is doing projects. So mostly I try to do projects that don't make any money is one of the main ways I do it. Or like, I don't know, like right now I'm like trying to help my friend who's a single mom, like make their watering system in their garden work so that they don't have to work as much and the gardening thing just goes. And it activates all the parts of my brain I like where I'm like puzzles and like plumbing. Yeah. I can't believe there's a part of my brain that loves plumbing, but I lived in an off-grid cabin for a long time. So I, you know, I like doing things I'm vaguely good at. And so in terms of raw self-care, I kind of got to get drag kicking and screaming into it. I like hiking. I like... You know, my truck is built out into a camper. My dog is very needy because he's a puppy. And so I got to go on walks with him a lot. Yeah, I don't know. I actually honestly need to get better at self-care. I have too many plates spinning. But sometimes the thing that seems fun is setting up new plates to spin. So maybe my idea of self-care is finishing projects, right? Because then they're done.
There you go.
And then you don't have to think with them anymore. And then the other thing I did is I require all new hobbies to be physical instead of on the computer because everything I do for money is on a computer.
Fair.
So all hobbies, woodworking, gardening, anything like that.
That is a good tip.
That's a good one. I like it. You unplug. Mm-hmm. Yes, we know you need to go on and move on to the bigger and better projects and the 10,000 plates you've got going on. But where can our listeners find you?
Well, first of all, this is a bigger and better. I am so excited that you all had me on this show. I'm like, I really think it's cool that what you all do. But where can people find me? You can find me on Twitter at Magpie Killjoy. You can find me on Instagram at Margaret Killjoy. Instagram is like mostly me posting pictures of my dog or like instruments I make, whereas Twitter is me pretending like I would never fall into arguing about discourse on the internet. No, sir, not me. And mm-hmm. You can pre-order my book from AK Press. If you pre-order it before September 20th, you'll get an art print that is done by my friend, same person who did the cover art. And you can order that from AK Press or a number of participating bookstores, including cooperatively run bookstores like Firestorm Books in Asheville or Red Emma's Books in Baltimore. Because I think cooperatives are cool. Worker cooperatives are awesome. And you can find me on whatever you listen to this podcast with. You can find me at Cool People Who Did Cool Stuff. And you can go back in time and look up the Jane Collective episode in order to listen to Samantha as well. And you can listen to Live Like the World is Dying, which is also on your podcast app.
Yes. Thank you so much for being here. It was such a delight. Please come back because there's so many things you're saying. And I was like, oh, resonating with me. You're also my best friend as well.
Yay. This is awesome.
I feel like we had three other subjects that we need to tackle.
I know. I was like, I want to talk about this, but I can't talk about The Hobbit right now. Okay.
Oh, but we should sometime.
I would love to. Also preparedness. That would be great.
Okay.
Yes. Well, until that date, thank you so much for joining us. Come back anytime. Listeners, if you would like to contact us, you can. Our email is stephaniamomstuff@iheartmedia.com. You can find us on Twitter at @MomStuffPodcast or on Instagram at @StuffIveNeverToldYou. Thanks, as always, to our super producer, Christina.
Thank you.
And thanks to you for listening. Stuff I've Never Told You is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, you can check out the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association, member FDIC.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast hosts Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.